Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books. And my guest today is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Gilbert King, who's out with a new work of nonfiction, Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found. The book details the story of a white, mentally impaired man falsely accused of rape in Jim Crow-era Florida, and the journalist who pushes to uncover the story. I've way oversimplified it, but we'll get into it with Gilbert. Gilbert, your 2012 book, Devil in the Grove, won the Pulitzer Prize. In that book, you told another story of Sheriff Willis McCall, who served for nearly 30 years in Central Florida from the 40s until the early 70s. He's further detailed in this new book, Beneath a Ruthless Sun. Introduce us to this character who seems, if it was a fictional character, it would be too unbelievable.
Yeah, it really, I mean, honestly, I've had novelist friends tell me about that, and they said, if we put some of the things that he did in a novel, no one would believe it. He had a long reign of terror in Lake County, Florida. He's one of the most powerful people in the state of Florida. And, you know, one of the sayings around Lake County was that the citrus groves in Lake County were fertilized with the bodies of black men. And, you know, and when I look through the FBI reports, they seem to indicate that he might have personally killed between 25 and 30 people, which I found just absolutely stunning. But, you know, when you go through these FBI reports, these are never, like, out in the public, so nobody really sees these things, but you have informants talking about the things that he did. And, you know, he was just one of these people who controlled and kept the labor force aligned in the citrus groves. And basically his job was to keep white supremacy intact. And so 28 years he served in Lake County.
Well, you know, 1957, when this book takes place, when it begins in Okahumka, Florida, this is post-Brown versus Board of Education. So what is the racial attitude like of the government officials in the area when the South is starting to be desegregated?
Well, that's what the interesting thing about this is. You had this landmark desegregation case, Brown versus Board, in 1954. And what you saw after that was sort of the breakdown in the race relations after the Brown decision. So you had whites who were just, we are not going to go to school with blacks. And all of a sudden there were these protests. There was pressure put on school officials. Even parents of children were threatened wanting to go to school. And so this was a really horrible time in Florida's history, just like the rest of the South. You had a rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan. You had these white citizen councils popping up. And so when this story takes place in 1957, race relations were really at among the worst since, you know, back in the 30s when there were lynchings constantly. So that was sort of the environment when this story takes place.
So December of 1957, Blanche Knowles, she's a local socialite there, she's mother of three and wife of this citrus baron named Joe Knowles, is raped at her home. What's the setting of the crime scene?
Well, the setting is the husband was out of town, allegedly on business, so Blanche was home with her three young children, and in the middle of the night, someone breaks into her house, and she's raped, and she reports it to police, describing her attacker as a husky black man with bushy hair. And so Sheriff McCall and the deputies round up the usual suspects. They take 24 young black men into custody, and they settle on their one suspect, who is the nephew of the civil rights activist in town who's trying to integrate the University of Florida, and his case is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. So this suspect was definitely meant to embarrass the Virgil Hawkins family. But then something very curious happens. A couple days later, Joe Knowles returns home, and suddenly, all the African-American suspects are released, and they arrest a white, mentally disabled teenager by the name of Jesse Daniels.
And Jesse Daniels was known around the town as the boy on the bike. How mentally disabled was he?
Well, he was definitely mentally disabled in the fact that his school officials had labeled him not educable. So they were saying that, you know, it had taken him 4 years to get through fifth grade. So they just said, you got to get him out of school. He's just not advancing. The interesting thing about him is, and he is still alive. I've interviewed him. He is not as mentally disabled as I think they reported him earlier on. He had actually sort of a Rain Man-esque kind of quality to him, where he could remember everything, names, dates, people. I was struck 50 years later, he could talk about things as clear as day. But if you handed him a dollar and said, give me 75 cents back, he would not be capable of doing that. So he definitely had some, mental disability. But he was actually very docile. Everyone who had ever known him said he was not violent, would not hurt a fly. And that was the impression I got from talking to him.
Despite the description by Blanche Knowles of her attacker being a husky black man with bushy hair, why is now a white young man named Jesse Daniels the suspect? What influence did her husband have in procuring Daniels' arrest?
Well, that's really the million-dollar question. And I think Mabel Norris Reese, who's the reporter in this particular case, she begins to think that something's fishy about this. And she's had run-ins with Willis McCall in the past, going back to Groveland. So she's already known what he's all about. And she's the only one who's writing about this because I think the family was very influential. There were a lot of wealthy people that sort of had, were covering and sort of had their backs. But Mabel wasn't one of them. She reported on this, and she begins to suspect that it's quite possible that the reason this was done, releasing the black suspects and turning attention to a white person, was that it would have been more socially acceptable for this family to have Blanche would have been attacked by a white person rather than a black person. And so she begins to see this sort of social stigma of this, and that's what she proceeds on that theory, that this was the reason it was done.
That reasoning or that line of thinking seems absolutely insane in looking through a 2018 lens. But at the time, was that an acceptable idea of how the crime should have been investigated?
It is strange, and I've talked to people about it who'd never heard anything quite like that before. But, I did talk to one particular citrus grower in Lake County, an old-timer, and I said, what do you think happened? Why was this done? And he was very matter-of-fact about it. He said it had to be done. He said Blanche was one of life's flowers, and she would have been a pariah if this had not been done. So they needed the official story that, oh, no, it was a white person. A black person did not defile Blanche. And so they settled on a white person. And so I think that's part of the story that's just most disturbing and most surprising.
And then common sense would tell me Jesse Daniels is arrested, arraigned, pleads not guilty, gets a lawyer, goes to trial. That's not what happened here, right?
No, and that's another thing. When you look back at the justice system, you see, well, this is Jesse Daniels couldn't afford a lawyer on his own, so he had to get a court appointed because this is a death penalty crime. So the person that they used to be his court-appointed attorney is the former prosecutor who has all these connections with white supremacy. He's a segregationist. He's really good friends with the sheriff. He's really good friends with the prosecutor, and the judge. And so they bring him in, and his first thing to do is say, this boy's guilty. We got to send him away to a mental institute. And the reason they did that was they knew they couldn't bring him to trial. They had no evidence against him. So they just declared him insane and threw him in a mental institute for 14 years.
You talk a lot in the book about the Florida State Hospital at Chattahoochee. It really becomes a main character in the book. How heinous was that facility at the time insofar as the treatments that the patients received there?
Well, I mean, this became a big warehouse for people that all it took was to get someone committed to Chattahoochee was a signature from a judge. And so you had women in there who were, maybe spending too much on their husband's credit card, and the husband would just get so mad that he'd get a judge to sign an order saying she had a shopping addiction, and they were turning up at Chattahoochee. You had people in there that could not get out, and if you look at it, they had some of the most hardened criminals mixed with people like Jesse living in the same barracks, basically. It was just a horrible place. You'd sometimes were just sent there. You didn't see a doctor for a year. You weren't really giving any kind of rehabilitation or any therapy. Basically, they would drug you up on Thorazine. There were lobotomies happening there, shock therapy. It was a place you did not want to be. Many people actually said you'd be better off in a state prison rather than Chattahoochee.
Well, we're talking with Gilbert King about his brand new book, Beneath a Ruthless Sun. It's a fascinating read. Gilbert, the time that Jesse was at the hospital, that was also the era of Dr. Walter Freeman and the lobotomobile that he would take. Can you kind of describe some of these crazy physical practices that they used on people, including lobotomies at these hospitals?
Yeah, that was probably the most disturbing thing because people, it felt like if there was nothing to hope for, no progress, that maybe the last resort would be a lobotomy. And they introduced this surgery where they would drill into your skull and just sort of, it was very unscientific. And then they realized that they needed to do this more because they had so many people coming back from World War II who were, you know, in shell shock, and the population in these mental institutes exploded. And so they basically decided they needed a faster, easier form of lobotomy. And so one of the techniques was they would just take basically an ice pick that you would find in a kitchen somewhere and try to sort of sedate the patient a little bit and then just drive it into their eye sockets and just scrape in there and until they hit brain tissue. And that way, that was done much faster than a regular surgery. And these guys would come into a hospital and do a few of these a day and then drive off to the next hospital. It's just one of those things you can't even imagine.
You mentioned the journalist Mabel Norris Reese, who's really a hero of the book, and she tracked this story, thought there was something wrong. What personal toll did this take on her as far as how she was received in the community at the time by investigating this?
Right. Well, I think Mabel is really so interesting because, you know, she starts out, when she first arrives in Lake County, she's sort of buying into the sheriff's vision of this racial idyllic Eden, she said. But then once Willis McCall had shot those prisoners in Groveland, she started to look at things a little bit differently, and she started reporting on civil rights violations, you know, much to Sheriff McCall's, you know, displeasure. But when it came to this Jesse Daniels case, she was all over it, and she knew what the sheriff was about. And she reported on this, and basically what they did was they drove her out of town. Willis McCall and some friends got behind another newspaper, a rival newspaper. They threatened all the advertisers in Mabel's newspaper. And so business was just suddenly down with Mabel. She had no choice, but she had to leave Lake County. But she moved to Daytona Beach, and she stayed on this case. She was still the only one writing about this, writing to governor, saying something's wrong with this case. This kid is not guilty. And, you know, it took her 14 years, but ultimately she really did prevail, and it was because of her alone.
One of McCall's deputies, Evie Griffin, approached you at a book signing and really got you to go back to this place in Florida after you wrote Devil in the Grove. Can you kind of explain how inspirational he was, and if it hadn't been for him, would we have even seen this book?
I don't think so, because honestly, I'd been poking around for Lake County for about 5 years, and I'd only heard about this case very tangentially. And Evie came up to me at a book signing and said, you know, you got your book right, but you didn't get the whole story down here. And we started talking a little bit, and he just told me about this one case that haunted him. He said, we framed this kid for a crime he did not commit. And so I started looking around about it, and he told me, no one's going to talk to you about this because people are still around. They don't want this out there. It's very delicate. And I started filing Freedom of Information Act requests, and everything Evie was telling me was checking out. In fact, it got even more disturbing. And so I kind of got hooked on it. I was going to just do maybe an article as a follow-up, but once I started getting those FBI reports, I saw that this case was just much bigger, and it really deserved a book. And unfortunately, I should say, Evie passed away last week, but he did manage to get a book in his hand, and so his family was reading it to him right up until the very end.
In part of the subtitle of the book, you mentioned the word race. Here we have a white victim, a white rape victim, a white victim of the justice system. Sheriff's department's all white. The town folk are all white. How is this a race story?
It's interesting. It's just sort of turning race on its head. You know, Thurgood Marshall said something that really was never more apparent to me until I was researching this book. He said, you know, racism is not good for anyone. And basically what I learned when I was really researching this is that in order to uphold this vision of white supremacy, certain compromises and certain, you know, atrocities had to occur. White people were expected to perjure themselves in order to go along with this vision of white supremacy and uphold these racial mores. If you were a journalist researching this story, you might be driven out of town. You might, like Mabel had, her house was bombed, crosses were put up in her yard. In order to just uphold this whole vision of white supremacy, it affected all sorts of layers of people. And you know, Jesse said something to me once when I first met him. I asked him what his thoughts are on Sheriff Willis McCall, and he says, everybody was scared of him, black or white. That was his point to me, was that it didn't matter what color you were. You had to go his way. And I think that's really the thing I learned in this case, was that this form of racism was debasing to everyone who participated in it.
Well, that's just an amazing tale, and I'm so glad that you were able to get it down and get it out there for us to read and learn from. The book is Beneath a Ruthless Sun by Gilbert King. It's available now wherever your books are sold. Gilbert, fantastic offering and such an important topic, and thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks so much, Brian. I really appreciate it.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.